You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Farah.
And I'm Veronica Rickard. Coming up, we'll talk to Wisconsin's Department of Corrections Secretary about the use of solitary confinement in youth prisons.
First, on any given day, we might see a lot of people we don't know well or know at all. People walking on the sidewalk, the neighbor from down the street, the clerk at the store, the delivery person at work. For the most part, we probably don't interact with them a whole lot.
Our next guest says that's a lot of missed opportunities and that if we talked to some of those strangers, our lives would be better and more interesting.
Keo Stark joins us now. She's the author of the book, When Strangers Meet, How People You Don't Know Can Transform Your Life. Keo, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Hi, I'm excited to be here.
What got you started, Keo, talking with strangers?
Oh, it's funny. I grew up in a family where really that was part of our culture. Everyone talked to strangers, and I was well into my probably mid-20s before I realized that this was not a, you know, the way that everyone was raised, and it wasn't a completely universal sentiment that it was a good thing to talk to strangers. So that was when I really started to pay attention to why and what other people were doing.
In a nutshell, what do you think we get out of those interactions? I mean, in most cases, probably we don't become besties with the strangers that we talk to. So kind of what's in it for us?
Sure. So what I'm interested in actually has nothing to do with the becoming besties and getting close to people and, you know, repeated interactions. I'm really interested in these very specific fleeting moments. And I think that when you start to experience that and pay attention to it, you realize that you're getting a couple of really important things out of it. The first thing you're getting is a sense of intimacy. And this seems like a paradox because these are people you don't know very well. But when we talk about this need for closeness, for intimacy, we're talking in part about connectedness and belonging. And it's one of the really unusual and kind of exciting things about when you have a good interaction with a stranger. You have this momentary sense of belonging and connectedness. And this can come even from just exchanging a smile with someone on the street. You can certainly get it if you have a kind of more extended conversation. So that's one part of it. The other part of it that I think is really important is the way in which when we expose ourselves and open ourselves up to people who are different than we are, it really changes our understanding of them and kind of opens up our realm of social possibility.
Right. You write that there are political and social benefits, or there would be if more of us did this, if we talk to people who we don't know and people who are different than ourselves.
Yeah, definitely. And I think, you know, the idea of talking to people who are different than we are has gained, since I wrote the book, such intense importance in, you know, the wake of the election and the kind of fear and prejudice that is really coming to flower, unfortunately, in a lot of parts of the country. So I think, you know, when we talk to a stranger who's different than we are, you get kind of forced to treat them and understand them as an individual with a context, with beliefs, with thoughts, with feelings, with emotions, and not as a member of a category, not as a stereotype. And that in and of itself, that focus on the individual really is a moment of possibility for all of us.
We've also been hearing over the past, I guess, decade or so that America is becoming a lonelier place. There was the book Bowling Alone, other people writing about how people kind of live in their own little pods and don't bust out of them. They've got their earbuds in. Does this help treat loneliness the way we might feel separated from people?
I think it does in a lot of ways. I mean, when we talk about loneliness in that way of kind of isolation, I think we're talking about kind of alienation from a feeling of community. And the more that you do talk to strangers, to even just, you know, exchange smiles, greet people, say hello, that brings us back into a feeling of being part of a community, of kind of being in this together. And I think that does really cut back on one facet of this loneliness, and it's definitely the bowling alone kind of loneliness. You know, there's also the loneliness of the heart, you know, when somebody is separated from their family, and I think that's different.
We're talking about talking with strangers. Keo Stark is with us. Her book is When Strangers Meet, How People You Don't Know Can Transform Your Life. Keo, we've talked about why talking to strangers can help us out. Let's get into how. Now, not all of us grew up like you, wanting to just talk to other people randomly. Some of us are maybe introverts or shy. How do we get started? How do we make some of the first steps toward talking to, you know, the person at the counter, the person on the bus, whatever?
Sure. So it's a great question. And, you know, it's all easy for me to say, go talk to strangers when it's a part of the great pleasure of my life. But yeah, I think one of the things, if you're, you know, just trying to change your orientation towards public space and make contact with people, is to first pay attention to how people do interact in the places where you're going and you know, coming across people. So you could take a walk and you don't have to talk to anybody, let's say through the park, but watch what people are doing and when they do say hello to each other and when they don't. And try to get a feeling of that, of what the kind of local rules are, to give yourself some confidence. Because we're all operating by these sort of unwritten rules of any given place. And once you can see them, they're invisible. We don't really talk about them, but we all know what they are. And once you start to see them, it gives you a lot more confidence. I think another thing, if you're nervous about like feeling awkward or feeling rejected, one of my favorite pieces of advice is just go somewhere where you're not in your ordinary path. So go to a different neighborhood or a different park than you usually go to, a different dog run, whatever it might be, and try it out there. Because if you feel awkward or any other kind of negative feeling, you're not going to see those people again. You know, you're not going to walk back by that park and have someone say like, oh, that's that weird person who said hello to me. There's one other thing that's really, really important, and that is having a sensitivity to people who don't want to be talked to. So there's a lot of context and a lot of reasons why somebody might want everyone to leave them alone. And the main signal of that is somebody who's not making eye contact. If people aren't making eye contact, just don't do it. Don't talk to them. You know, you're looking for people who are making eye contact, which is the way that somebody shows themselves to be open.
You were talking before about how you're interested in these moments of flash intimacy. Can you tell us a story or two where you actually feel like these conversations went well and you had that moment of feeling really connected with somebody?
Sure. I mean, you know, the other day, it's been kind of winter here. I'm in New York City. And it's that point in winter where everyone's a little depressed and dreary. And I walked by somebody on my block and said hello to them. And there was a guy sitting on a stoop a few doors down. And he looked up and said hello. And he smiled and he was like, see, it's like dominoes. You say hello and then everybody says hello. And I was like, yes, that's exactly how it should work. Another thing that I've noticed lately in terms of longer conversations, you know, there's this sort of triteness of like, who wants to talk about the weather? The weather's boring. And I think there is a certain sort of social meaning to saying, oh, hey, it's a nice day, isn't it? It's just this basic acknowledgement. But a longer conversation, okay, nobody wants to talk about that. What I've found is if you talk about food, you get pretty much straight into like the meaning of life. this is not something I knew. This is something I've learned in the past like 6 weeks. I think I had several conversations. One guy was talking about, it's a nice day for fishing. I said, do you fish? He's telling me how to cook the fish. He's talking about his entire worldview about health. Another guy, I told him I was a vegetarian, and we ended up getting into Islam and the slaughter of lambs and his political views. And he was from Egypt. You know, it's like it's some kind of mainline into people's a kind of openness about who people really are.
We're talking with Keo Stark right now. She's the author of When Strangers Meet, How People You Don't Know Can Transform You. She says we get a lot out of talking to strangers.
And we want to hear from you about this at 800-642-1234. Do you talk to strangers? What kind of reactions do you get? And what, if anything, do you get out of it? Do you like it when people strike up conversations with you or even just say hi? Or would you rather not? And do you have questions for our guests about how to get started? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page.
We'll pick up the conversation in just a little bit. Stay with us here on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. We continue our conversation now with Keo Stark. She's the author of the book When Strangers Meet. She says we can get a lot out of talking to strangers, and she's sharing some advice on how to do it.
And you can join the conversation at 800-642-1234. Do you like to talk to strangers, or do you kind of go out of your way to avoid it? Have you learned something by striking up a conversation with somebody you didn't know? Or do you have questions for our guest about how to get started and give it a whirl talking to somebody who's a stranger? Call 800-642-1234, or you can post on the Central Time Facebook page.
We'll go right to our callers. Anthony is with us in Green Bay. Anthony, hi.
Hi.
What did you want to tell us about, Anthony?
I just wanted to tell you about my experience of talking with strangers. I know a lot of times people don't enjoy engaging in conversation, but I really think it's intriguing when you get to see all walks of life, even if they aren't interested in you.
Kind of breaking up there, Anthony, but Anthony's saying he finds it intriguing meeting people from different walks of life, even in just brief conversations, Keo, and that's part of what it's all about.
I absolutely agree, yeah, and I think, you know, one thing, when you're walking around the world and you're talking to strangers, you are in this kind of open moment, and it really can spark your curiosity. And, you know, I feel like everybody needs more of that.
I used to hear from my friends who had visited Ireland often that they felt that Americans were bad at talking to strangers, but that in Ireland, everyone struck up conversations with people, and it was just what you did there, and it made for a more pleasant daily existence. Do you think there's something to that? Is there something about how Americans feel less comfortable talking to strangers?
Well, there are definitely different conventions in different countries and different cultures. I think that Americans tend to have a more awkward relationship to talking to strangers than people do in other cultures where it's just, you know, part of what everyone does. In the Middle East, for example, it would be considered rude not to say hello to a stranger. You know, you're likely to be invited back to someone's house for coffee if you ask them for directions. You know, in other places, in Germany, and these are wild generalizations, but, you know, they've been kind of confirmed to me and anecdotally expressed. In Germany, there are things that are more and less appropriate to ask a stranger. So if you're striking up a conversation with someone, we ask each other all the time in America, like, oh, what do you do for a living? And that would be quite rude. That would be like, why do you want to know? That's very nosy. But people are happy to talk about, like, logistical things. How did you get here to this party? You know, what, you know, did you take the subway or a car? How long did it take you? Was there traffic? Like, that's all fair game and reasonable territory.
We'll go back to our callers now. Darlene with us in Oshkosh. Darlene, hi.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
What did you want to tell us about, Darlene?
Well, I love talking to strangers, and so has my mother. And it is true, you got to make the eye contact. I smile, I get smiles in return. And sometimes, even in a checkout line, like after Christmas this year, there's a young gentleman behind me, and he's probably in his 30s, and I'm a grandma. And so we were talking, because we made great eye contact, and eventually I asked him, well, what was your best Christmas gift, if you can share it? And he said, the birth of my son.
Wow.
Oh, I know. And it was just like, oh, my God, really? And then we started talking, and it was wonderful. I still have a warm feeling talking about that.
And now you have a story to share yourself, Darlene.
I do.
Well, thank you for sharing it with us. Keo, yeah, we get these little, I don't know, vignettes, these little glimpses into other people's lives.
Well, and what I really love about that story is you asked such a great question. I mean, there are questions that give people an opportunity to tell you something really true and honest about themselves. And you hit on one of those kind of questions. What's the best present you got for Christmas? Is an invitation to tell a personal story. I love that.
Are there other good questions like that that you recommend?
Yeah, you know, it's funny. It really depends on the situation. Like, that was a kind of brilliant situational question. I would rather ask somebody, like, what they had for lunch than ask them what they do for a living. When I meet somebody at you know, some sort of formal event, I often ask them what they did today rather than ask them what they do for a living or what their job is or where they live. Because that, you know, chances are there's a story in what you did today. Even if it's one person said to me, like, you know, I answered emails all day. And I asked him at that point, what's your job? And he said, I'm a figurehead. He worked for a small company. you know, like his job was just to be present and be the face of something. And we got in an interesting conversation about what that feels like. So that's one of my favorite things, is kind of taking the expected question and trying to open it up to allow something more personal.
Let's take another phone call here. We've got Amy on the line with us in Milwaukee. Amy, hi.
Hi. I just wanted to say that my husband and I both talk to strangers on a regular basis. I'll go for a walk in the parkway in the morning, and just as I'm passing somebody, I will say, good morning, and the look on their face of surprise that somebody actually said good morning to them, and then when they say good morning back to me, I kind of give myself a thumbs up, because it's kind of my goal to get somebody to say something back to me. Because in today's world, you know, people have tunnel vision, especially with their earbuds in and everything. And so it's like my personal goal that somebody says hello back to me. And it actually makes my day then, too. And my husband, no matter where he goes, he always strikes up a conversation with people. And it's sometimes in doing so, you find out what a small world this actually is, because he's come in with conversations with total strangers, and all of a sudden it's, well, where'd you go to high school? And then they tell each other, oh, did you know so-and-so? Oh, yeah, I've known them for years. And, you know, it's the 6 degrees of separation, I think that's what it is. And it's just kind of refreshing, and I just think it makes the world a kinder place. And when you make that eye contact, you take that edge off.
Amy, thanks for sharing all those experiences. So Amy's made it a goal in life to get people to respond to her, which makes me wonder, is this kind of hard, though? Do a lot of people not want to talk? Kyle?
I think that it really varies, again, by situation. But I agree that moment where someone is surprised and appreciative that you've said hello to them, that you've kind of recognized their humanity, is really wonderful. And you know, when they return it, it's this moment of mutual recognition. And I think that's the tiny moments of this feeling of connectedness that I'm talking about. And it's so great to hear all these people talking about how much they love this. One thing that I also think about a lot is, again, for people who this is not second nature. And in When Strangers Meet, there's a series of what I call expeditions to give you a kind of contrivance to go out in the world and talk to people in different ways. And I think that those are in varying levels of difficulty, so they may be really fun also for people who do this all the time but want to push things further.
Thanks for the call, Amy. Talking to Keo Stark, author of the book When Strangers Meet, How People You Don't Know Can Transform You. And we've got Ken with us next, calling from Madison. Ken, hi.
Hi, how you doing?
Good. Do you talk to strangers?
I do. I'm a little older than maybe some of your guests. I'm 68, and when I was growing up, that was just what you did. You know, you sat down on the bus or on the train or the plane. You were expected to talk to the person next to you because they didn't have cell phones and laptops. It was just the sort of thing that you did. And so I still expect to do that, but like last summer when I went to Brazil for the Olympics, I looked around the airport. Everybody there had their head down, and they're looking at their cell phone or their laptop. And it's really hard to strike up a conversation with somebody who's doing their best to, you know, ignore the rest of the world.
Ken, thanks a lot for that call. And Keo, I'll admit, on a plane, I'll have a book ready to rock and look at it. And I think I may be doing it partly as a barrier to conversation. How do we overcome that? How do we put down the book or technology and open ourselves up to this?
Well, you know what? On a plane, I do the same thing. Like, you're stuck on a plane if you open yourself up to having a conversation with someone and you find them really irritating. You've got a long plane ride ahead of you. So, you know, we definitely use conversation shields appropriately. But I think you do want to think about how much of the time you spend with your nose and your phone, and try to just promise yourself, all right, I'm going to if you walk to work, you know, I'm going to walk 3 blocks with my phone in my pocket. I'm going to challenge myself. If I'm riding the bus, like, I'm going to not listen to my headphones and see what how that feels and what happens. You know, we rely on these things to make us feel safe in a way, emotionally safe. And so it's a little bit of a risk to put them down, but I encourage everyone to give that a try.
Let's take one more quick call from Joan in Madison. Joan, hi.
Hi. I was just going to share that I'm the youngest of 5 girls in my family, and my sisters always tease me that I view the entire world as a friend waiting to happen. And they generally get irritated with me, and it makes me laugh because why wouldn't you want to say hello to, there's certain circumstances where you're not going to, but I guess it just makes me feel bad for them that they don't want to be out there talking to other people and perhaps meeting someone interesting. And then my comment or question was, in our children, my daughter will be different because of who I am, but with the way we raise our children and having fear of strangers and to be careful, do you see that this is going to become even more of a lost art?
Joan, thanks for that. And just a couple seconds for your response, Kyle.
I'm campaigning against it being a lost art. And I think, you know, we need to model for our children that it's okay to talk to strangers, and also what the boundaries are of appropriateness and safety.
We'll leave it there. Keo, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you.
We're talking to Keo Stark. She's the author of the book When Strangers Meet, How People You Don't Know Can Transform You. On the Central Time Facebook page, we have a link to an article she wrote about talking to people while traveling in particular. And while you're there, you can share your thoughts and the stories you've heard, maybe, while talking to strangers. Grant Fiesel was an offensive lineman in the NFL. During his career, he took repeated hits on the football field that resulted in traumatic concussions. His wife says the brain trauma changed his personality from a loving husband to a verbally abusive alcoholic whose excessive drinking eventually led to his death.
Later, it was discovered that he had CTE, chronic traumatic encephalopathy. That's a degenerative brain disease found in people who have suffered a severe blow or repeated blows to the head, and a disease that's becoming commonly associated with the game of football.
Now, Cindy Fiesel has devoted her life to raising awareness of CTE and the dangers of repetitive head injury. In a new book, she shares the story of what happened to her husband, a man who destroyed his brain playing a game he loved.
Cindy Fiesel is the author of After the Cheering Stops, an NFL wife's story of concussions, loss, and the faith that saw her through. She was married to former NFL lineman Grant Fiesel for 29 years. He died in 2012. Cindy, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you for having me. I appreciate it.
Well, Cindy, your husband's last words were, if I'd known what I loved most would end up killing me and taking away everything I loved, I would have never done it. Do you think that players today know enough about the potential for brain injury if they play that sport and take enough hits to the head?
Yes, I don't think it's talked about enough. I think that we see all the glitz and glamour, and we see the money, and don't understand what can happen when actually the lights go down and it's over. I say there should be a reality series that goes on after every NFL game to show what life is like when football is done. And I know some people have, you know, a great life and they are not affected. Every single player is not going to be affected by this, but the chances are very high because it's a sport-induced degenerative brain disease. And the repetitive hits are what causes this. And the concussions compound this disease. So, while you're playing, you don't think about those things as much as you do when you're done.
And this is a disease, this brain trauma, that affected not just your husband's life and his health, but it affected his entire family's life together, your relationship with him, relationship with your children, your financial status. And now you're trying to bring attention to this. Why did you want to tell this story right now?
Well, because it's in the current events. It's in the news almost every day. It's very important for me to help people understand that this is a real disease. It's It's brain trauma caused by a sport, and not just football, but all high-impact sports. I'm saying soccer, hockey, anything that you could hit your head, boxing, wrestling, all of those things are very serious, cause very serious trauma to the head. And so I just think that more and more people need to start hearing the facts, what really can happen in these sports.
I want to start at the beginning of your story. What kind of person was your husband, Grant, before the brain trauma and the problems that came along with that?
Oh, he was awesome. He was a beautiful man, and he was not only beautiful to look at, but he was also just super smart. He was an academic, All-American, all 5 years in college. He won every award that there was to win at our college as far as academics goes, as well as athletic, so it was a great combination. I'd say he was a Renaissance man. He loved poetry, and he loved music, and we had a lot of common interests. He was a gentle giant. So he was everything that anybody would ever be looking for.
So he played football from the time. He was already a football player when you met him, and he went on to play in NFL teams. How long did that career last, and what was it like for him?
Well, he played 117 games in the NFL over 10 years, and he did have some serious injuries, and I thought to be career-ending injuries, but he continued to play. He had a serious knee injury, and he had a lot of physical ailments that started taking a toll on him at the end of his career. After a serious staph infection, he started coming in with little bags of pills, and they were unmarked, not sure what they were, but, you know, I found out later they were Percocet. However, he had trouble sleeping. He just had trouble being comfortable. I mean, you know, people forget that this is a human body that plays this game. And so every week when we're cheering on, hit them harder, you know, the player has a tough time the day after just getting around. It's a very difficult to overcome all the aches and pains that you have. He also started coming in the house and bringing in six-packs and sacks, which was not unusual, you know, for him to just, for people to bring in a six-pack, but to bring a six-pack in and drink it all, put it back in the bag, and then take it out to the dumpster. It was unusual behavior. So between the pills and the alcohol, that was definitely not what he'd done in the past. When he retired, the night he retired, he drank a bottle of Jack Daniels. All of those things were not in character to who he'd been prior. Also, the night that he retired, he gave me a small box. It was a gift wrapped up because our anniversary was coming up soon, and he was retiring, so he gave me a gift. And inside the box was a diamond ring, and it was identical to one that he'd given me a year prior. Well, that certainly wasn't normal behavior for him because he had been so meticulous and he was so organized and he kept up with things so well. It was unusual behavior for him to do any of these things.
We're talking with Cindy Fiesel right now. She's the author of the new book, After the Cheering Stops, and she's sharing her story right now of what happened to her husband, Grant Fiesel, after his 10 years in the NFL, and talking about CTE, the traumatic brain injury, and the dangers there. And Cindy, you didn't know at the time that your husband was reacting to physical problems in the brain. You just knew that, that things were spiraling out of control. So how did you deal with what was happening?
Well, it was really difficult because I call it the slow fade. It would just be a little bit at a time. After he retired, one day I was putting up clothes in his closet, and I found a bottle of Crown Royal stuffed back into his closet. And I left it out, and I said to him, what is this, and why is it in your closet? He said, oh, I got it at a golf tournament, and, you know, I put a little bit in my Diet Coke at night because before I go to bed, it helps me to sleep. And so those things, again, were just not normal behavior patterns. I didn't know what to think. I knew that he was drinking more and more, and he was complaining more and more about health issues. He would say, you don't have any idea of what I'm dealing with, and I didn't. I had no idea. I just thought that, you know, I was dealing with somebody becoming an alcoholic because he just drank so much and so frequently. So it was a slow fade, but it spiraled out towards the end, and it got very serious. And then, of course, I didn't even know anything about CTE until after his death, and I was looking at the Mayo Clinic's website. Just looking up to see what the symptoms of CTE were, just to help myself understand it more. And it was difficulty thinking, impulsive behavior, depression, short-term memory loss, difficulty planning and carrying out tasks, emotional instability, substance abuse, irritability, aggression, speech difficulties, motor impairment, vision and focus problems, trouble with smell, and dementia. He had had all of those. So I was stunned to think that all of those things that had happened during his lifetime had been symptoms to this disease, this brain trauma. It was overwhelming to me. It just it made me overwhelmingly sad and just devastated me. And in the book, I talk about at length about, you know, all the different stories that coincided with my journals and my writings that I'd kept over the years.
So all those years when he was struggling, you never knew. No one ever said to you, you know, hey, Cindy, we think it might be CTE. It might be this brain trauma that some professional players are having and other people. So why do you think it took so long to come out?
Well, now, towards the very end of his life, he was saying, you know, I think I may have what Mike Webster had. I think I may have what, you know, Junior Seau had. And so he did speak of these people, but again, when you've been living in this life that had just deteriorated, you know, I didn't go sit and look these things up. I didn't have any idea. I didn't know. I just thought, you know, I really didn't even think about it. But he was thinking about it, and he was talking about it. I didn't know enough about it. I hadn't heard about it the way we're hearing about more of the symptoms now. So it was overwhelming to me to think that he had really been dealing with not only addiction, but he'd been dealing with obviously the pain and just the decline in his health due to the traumatic brain disease.
And the official medical cause of your husband's death was liver failure from the alcohol abuse, but after his death, his brain was donated to the Concussion Legacy Foundation. What did it feel like to realize, you know, as you said, as you were looking at those Mayo lists and you got the diagnosis that, yes, he had CTE, what did it feel like to have that answer finally?
Well, it made more sense to me for sure, because for so many years I'd just been mad and sad and emotionally in a bad place. And I'm going to have to take some credit for the fact that I became a huge codependent, constantly hiding all the things that he was doing. And so people didn't even realize that he had gotten to be severe with his symptoms until the very end of his life, when it just spiraled out of control. So I was just overwhelmed. It scared me so much to think about, you know, the fact that I wished I could have done something. I know that I couldn't have, but I thought if I just had more facts, if I'd known more. I didn't want anybody else to go through what I'd been through. That's one of the reasons why I was so thankful that the book, After the Cheering Stops, was it was just great for me to write it. It was therapeutic for me to write it, because I'd had so many years of just not knowing. Navigating in the darkness, Grant and I, neither one having any idea really what was going on with him. So I say, if I can save one person by writing this book, and they could look at it and think, man, this is what's going on in our life. I need to get my loved one to a clinic or somewhere where they can have at least be measured to see what's going on in their life. There's not a cure for it, but you can definitely go to different hospitals and you can be under care. I suggest going to Dr. Daniel Amen's clinic at theamenclinics.com. He has done a lot of research on the brain, and he has seen a lot of professional football players and a lot of athletes. So I'm saying, try to get your loved one there. He's got clinics all over the United States.
And we'll get back and hear more in just a bit as we talk with Cindy Fiesel. She's the author of the new book, After the Cheering Stops. And she's with us sharing her story of what happened to her husband, Grant Fiesel, after his 10 years in the NFL, and how traumatic brain injuries devastated their marriage and their lives. And she's now, as you heard, speaking out in an attempt to raise awareness of CTE and the dangers of repetitive head injury.
You can join in at 800-642-1234. If you're a parent, do you let your kids play football or other contact sports? Do you worry about concussions, brain injuries, these long-term impacts? If you've played yourself, have you suffered these kind of brain injuries? Do you still experience issues stemming from them now? As a football fan, do you worry about these kind of injuries? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Central Time Facebook page.
We're talking right now with Cindy Fiesel. She's the author of the book, After the Cheering Stops, an NFL wife story of concussions, loss, and the faith that saw her through. In addition to sharing her personal story, she's speaking out in an attempt to raise awareness of CTE and the dangers of repetitive head injury.
You can join the conversation at 800-642-1234. Have brain injuries and concussions turned you off from the game of football or other contact sports? Would you let your kids play? Do you think there's a future for the sport? What, if anything, would you like to see changed in the game of football and other contact sports for that matter? Call in now at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also post on the Central Time Facebook page.
And Cindy, in recent years, you've been getting into speaking out, reaching out to educate parents and individuals about the dangers of CTE, this brain trauma injury. What are the most important things that you think parents should know about?
Well, I think that they should check their school's policies. I'm saying, you know, do we sign our kids up and not have any clue what's going on? Read. Look at all the resources. Find out what your school's policy is on contact sports. Educate yourself about, do they have a waiver? Is there a waiver at your school that says this sport can cause a traumatic brain injury or traumatic brain trauma? Do they do a baseline pre-injury for every athlete? There's a great test called the King-Divitt test, and it's an eye movement test. If your child has any kind of hits during a game that you're not certain whether they have a concussion or not, they can be analyzed right on the sidelines. Does your school offer that? Just check the resources. More than anything, you know, we teach our kids to be careful when they're walking across the street. So why wouldn't we want to make sure that there's policies in place at the school that we entrust for them to go to with their athletics?
Now, are we just talking about football here? Or are we talking about other sports that could be something to be concerned about if you're a parent?
Definitely. I say all high-impact sports, soccer, wrestling, boxing, anything that you could have your brain could be moved back and forth. I said, I must have been asleep during science class when I was growing up. I had no idea that the brain was as soft as it is. And over the years, as I've been doing this research, I've just been shocked to find out that the brain is like butter or jello. In my opinion, there couldn't be a helmet in the world that could keep your brain from moving if it were to be hit with a high impact. So I'm just saying, do the research on how that is as well. Your brain is very delicate. So there's a good chance that your child could get a concussion during the school year when they're playing. 50% of them never report a symptom because they don't want to lose their spot. I think we all understand that, even all the way up to the NFL. You don't want to go out because if you do, you're going to lose your spot. So a lot of times the kids don't even talk about the injury that they might get just in practice. The CDC says that concussions have doubled in the last 10 years. Boys are more common to get football concussions in football. Girls, it could be in soccer. So there's just all sorts of ways that in the headbanging sports that they could really do some damage to themselves. And so I'm saying all parents, please do the research. See what can happen. Realize that CTE is a sport-related brain trauma. Repeated blows to the head cause a degenerative brain disease. The longer someone plays, the more likely the potential is to put them at risk for serious injury later on.
Let's take a caller now. We've got Jim with us in Appleton. Jim, hi.
Hi. I guess I had a son play football, and when he came home and talked about some of the things that are going on in the field, I was very concerned. And I'm so glad he's not playing anymore, and he's away from it. I really believe WIA needs to do more to get on it right away, and they aren't. They're sort of giving a blind eye toward injuries, and they really need to step to the plate and work on it. They could do like videos, they're taking videos of the game right away anyway. They could be reacting quicker to it, pulling kids that are doing nasty hits on other kids and get rid of the problem right away. That way they'll send a strong message to kids that are doing stuff they shouldn't be doing on the field that, hey, it's not tolerated.
Jim, thank you so much for that call and for sharing your own story there. And what do you think about that, Cindy? I mean, what responsibility does an organization like the WIAA or other youth sports coordinators, what responsibility do they have to keep kids safe?
I agree. I say that you shouldn't even be playing contact football, tackle football, until you're 14. I don't even think it's a good idea to play past 14 just because of what's happened to my husband. He's not alive anymore. We didn't know anything. Now we know so much more. It just surprises me that so many parents sign their kids up and they don't have any, or they don't act like they have any idea that this could happen to their child. And it's not random. It's happening more and more. 90% of the brains that have been looked at have CTE, have this disease. I mean, it's so important that parents are cautious, and I appreciate the caller. There could be so much more done, and I agree. Every school, anybody, any organization that allows children to play football or these high-impact sports needs to look at what the long-term effects could be.
And looking back at the NFL now, the NFL has been criticized for not doing enough to ensure player safety. I mean, they have implemented some changes. They've had medical spotters and neurological consultants on hand. That's a change. Do you think, though, that enough is being done right now?
No. And I think that, in my opinion, it's all about the money. And so why are they going to talk about the dangers when people are making millions and millions of dollars? I mean, it's a huge money maker. It's all about greed, in my opinion. So, again, they're not talking about what happens when these players quit. And, again, it's not every single player has an effect, but I'm telling you, all of them have something because they've got problems with some body part, their knees or their back or whatever. But nobody talks about what happens when it's over.
And Cindy, I want to ask you a bit about the money, because money was a problem for you as Grant was going through his alcoholism and trouble with his brain injury toward the end of his life. But do you think the NFL does enough to take care of their players who do have CTE and might need extra care?
No. No, I don't. We never even made a claim for any insurance claim or anything that went on with Grant, because we had no idea that whatever was happening to him was CTE. Again, he didn't have any surgeries. He didn't have anything done to his back or his knees or anything else. A lot of these guys have had all sorts of surgeries. And when you're done, you're done. And so I just think it's a huge problem, and I don't think that they talk about it enough. I think that there should be a waiver that every NFL player signs, and maybe there is. I don't know. No one talks about it. Is there a waiver that they sign that where they sign off and say, oh, you know, I know that I can have long-term brain effects and a possibility of having CTE. I would say now to anyone that wanted to even play college football, there needs to be a waiver on there that says, I know that I could have a traumatic brain disease at the end of my 4 years of playing college ball. There's kids that are dying of this disease. It's not just for college and NFL. Even children, there's so many that have died already and have CTE, and their brains are in a brain bank. I'm saying to everyone, look at being a brain donor. The Mayo Clinic has a great program. If you're going to let your child play a sport like this, and you know that the long-term effects could be something that could cause them to not live their entire life, think about donating brains, because it's needed to continue to form a timeline so that we know more and more about this disease.
Well, Cindy, I'm sorry for your loss, and thank you so much for joining us. Appreciate your time.
Thank you. I appreciate it very much.
Now, with Cindy Fiesel, she's the author of After the Cheering Stops, an NFL wife story of concussions, loss, and the faith that saw her through.
You can share your stories and your thoughts on what you've heard and on high-impact sports like football. Head over to the Central Time Facebook page and let us know what you think and what maybe your family has been through.